Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Other Animals for January 24th, 2020. I'm your host, Laurent Levy. And if you're listening to us live, either on the live stream or on your AM dial, well, how quaint, then that can only mean one thing, and that is that you're not listening to or watching that other event going on right now about 140 miles or so right from these studios. So, confessions from an otherwise informed citizen. I'm not just not watching it because I'm here with you right now. I'm not watching it, period. I mean, I like doing this show, not just because my guests are extraordinary, but because I like to think that if you're listening, you're kicking around what they have to say, maybe considering a point of view or idea you hadn't thought of before. After the show, you might Google something you heard, you might check out something they published or produced, or you might simply reject it outright. Hopefully not. The point is that if you are listening, you're very likely also considering what's being said to some degree or another. I do not think that's happening at all down in the Senate chambers. There is nothing anyone can say or argue on one side that has any chance at all of changing a mind on the other side. Zero. It is, to my mind, the ultimate act of futility. Now, you can say that's because it's political, it's not the same thing as a social or scientific consideration of our relationship with non-human animals. There's no reason to be as entrenched in our attitudes toward animals as there is for a senator to be entrenched because the senator's job is quite literally at stake. She does what her constituents tell her, what her eyes see, what her heart knows, well, her own conscience be damned. And what motivates those constituents? Well, that's what everyone is always trying to figure out, isn't it? In politics, there's always this ideal of pliability, that given the right events, the right circumstances, the right leadership, minds can be changed, and what was absolute yesterday is absolutely not today. But here's the part I can't get my head around. Aren't there just some absolutes that are not pliable? Any that are so crystal clear and universal, they just can't be up for debate. I actually can't think of a few. Murder, of course, comes to mind. But even there are some cultures where honor killing, I'm putting that up in air quotes, is considered justifiable. Well, how about child abuse? Well, that one seems fairly universal. But beyond that, and maybe one or two other exceptions, the answer is no. Pretty much any unimaginably horrible deed from one culture's perspective can be justified in another's. And if you try to impose an absolute judgment on that deed or behavior, you are committing a bias based on cultural relativism. We can't judge Koreans for eating dogs while we eat cows, the argument goes. Did you happen to see the videos this week of the pig forced to bungee jump as part of a theme park stunt? How about this waste of human flesh from Pinckneyville, Illinois, who was caught kicking and beating a disabled baby deer? Let that sink in a little. Kicking a disabled baby deer. That takes a special kind of stench, doesn't it? The bad news is that happens on a more or less daily basis to pigs and cows in slaughterhouses, yet to babies. The good news is that, thanks to people like today's guest, the Pinckneyville flower of humanity is being charged with felony animal torture and misdemeanor cruelty to animals. Maybe, just maybe, we are heading towards that consensus. That yes, abusing is something to be avoided, regardless of the species receiving that abuse. A sobering look at preventing cruelty to animals with Nicole Wilson of the Pennsylvania Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals today on The Other Animals. But first, it's time for Animals in the News. Right, we skipped a week last week with one of the companies that have gone vegan, so we're making up for it in a really big way here because this one comes from the world's largest food company. That's right, Nestle. That's right, Nestle is adding vegan sausages to its lineup of imitation meat products as the world's largest food company moves to secure its position in the booming market for plant-based foods. The Swiss company said Friday that it will sell soy-based bratwurst and, I'm going to try and pronounce this, chorizo-style sausages in 11 European markets under its Garden Gourmet brand starting in March. American shoppers will be able to purchase pea protein-based Sweet Earth sausages in April that come in habanero cheddar, Asian ginger scallion, and chicken apple flavors. Nestle will also offer a range of plant-based alternatives to deli meats in the United States. The products are the latest additions to Nestle's growing range of meat substitutes, which already includes burgers and schnitzel. The company made a big move into plant-based food last year when it launched its incredible and awesome burgers under its Garden Gourmet and Sweet Earth brands, respectively. On Thursday, U.S. restaurant chain Ruby Tuesday announced that it would trial the awesome burger in its stores, saying it could eventually become a permanent menu item. Nestle is competing against the likes, as you know, of Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, which have also linked agreements with retailers and restaurants to sell their plant-based products. And this goes on. It's interesting as we see more and more of these. I'm just waiting for the day when instead of comparing it, you know, saying this is fake meat and fake, it's going to be the other way around. That the what we know as quote unquote real meat now will become the product that has to be compromised. All right. Along that subject, here's a nice dovetail from coming off. Any listeners who listened to the previous show, Barry's show, this comes to us from Chicago. Chicago's vegan Jewish deli, Sam and Gertie's, sells out completely on opening weekend. If any listeners listening to the stream from Chicago, I have to check this out. Sam and Gertie's, which is a new all-vegan Jewish deli, opened last Friday in Chicago to a crowd of hungry customers and sold out of food by Saturday. Owner Gina Marino Kalish and her partner Andy Kalish opened the deli, described as the first vegan Jewish deli in the world, in Chicago's Sheridan Park neighborhood next door to the couple's popular vegan diner, Kalish, in the former space of their now-shuttered non-vegan pizzeria, Longacre. Named after Kalish's maternal grandparents, the deli serves plant-based versions of traditional Jewish deli items, including smoked ham and bagels, baked goods, knishes, latkes, eggs, and tuna salads, as well as hot sandwiches filled with brisket and schmaltz. Now, how do you make schmaltz vegan? All right. So many young, quote, so many sweet young people came out yesterday and ate everything we made for the whole weekend in one day, a note posted on Sam and Gertie's door with a picture of the real Sam and Gertie, read. We will be back in the kitchen and bakery tomorrow preparing extra for next weekend. As you can imagine, we don't like to disappoint. If you're looking for someone to kvetch to, try our grandson, Andy. He means well. Sam and Gertie's is just the latest in a string of new vegan eateries across the country, drawing massive crowds on opening day, which includes Oakland, California's soul food restaurant, Vegan Mob, which sold out of its offerings such as plant-based brisket, shrimp, po' boys, and smacaroni and cheese within 6 hours of opening its doors in October. Good trend. All right, here's another really positive story. I like this one. We're continuing moving west across the country now. We're in Los Angeles. And LA is going to build the largest wildlife bridge, which will allow animals to move freely across mountains. LA is currently designing it over a 10-lane freeway. The bridge is in final design stages and is targeted to be open in 2023. Once approved, it would go over the 101 freeway in Agoura Hills. The area is part of the Santa Monica mountain region, home to mountain lions and many other species. The bridge acts as a connector for species, allowing them to roam and move to other parts of the mountains. Segmentation affects many animals, including birds and lizards. Beth Pratt with the National Wildlife Federation told local news station KCL9, they're not just bridges. The animals have to feel safe. If we don't provide connectivity, they can't get dates outside their families. Like all of us, the 405 divide has killed many a romance. We're going to inspire the world. That many people are going to drive under this and know what's possible in LA. If LA can do it, nobody else has an excuse. Segmentation when animals are unable to interact, according to Pratt, affects many species of animals, including birds and lizards. Mountain lions were at risk of going extinct because they could not find mates outside their family. The bridge will be designed to blend into surroundings so that animals don't realize they're on a bridge. It will extend 165 feet over the freeway and is designed so that it's accessible and feels comfortable for a wide variety of animals. I'm intrigued with that just because of the public funding for that. This had to have support. This is not a cheap product. There's nothing in the article that says how much this is going to cost, who's paying for it, but it's a bridge. It's over a public highway. I'm going to assume there's there's public taxpayer support for that. And you can say what you want about California, but that says something, that support was there. I can't see that happening in specific other parts of the country. So way to go, LA. All right, last story. Coming back around here, this is really large. It's speaking about funding. Memphis Meat. You may remember a couple months ago we've had Paul Shapiro on a few times here, and he's sort of the authority, I think, in terms of what's happening with this. They call it Cell Ag, which is basically cell-based meat. It's the lab-grown, cultivated, cultured meat. Memphis Meats is probably the largest player in this group, and they announced on Wednesday they had raised $161 million. Let's try that again. $161 million in a Series B funding round. I'm not a financier, so I don't quite know what that means, but it's the largest investment ever made in the burgeoning cell-based meat industry. The round was led by Asia-based firm SoftBank Group and Temasek, and included additional funding from animal agriculture giants. This is where it gets interesting. Cargill and Tyson Foods. That's not a surprise, but it kind of is a surprise. They're seeing the light, right? Cargill and Tyson Foods, you all know, they're the biggest meat producers in the country. And if they're getting into this funding, then that signals something. They're serious. In 2017, Memphis Meats was the first cell-based meat company to close a Series A funding round, raising $17 million from a handful of major investors, including Virgin Group founder Richard Branson, billionaire Bill Gates, and entrepreneur Kimball Musk, all of which contributed to the company's current investment round. I am proud to invest once again in Memphis Meats, the world's largest leading cell-based meat company, Branson said. In the next few decades, I believe that cell-based meat will become a major part of our global meat supply. I cannot wait for that day. Founded by cardiologist Uma Valetti, Memphis Meat uses a small, just to review, how this works. Memphis Meat uses a small amount of animal cells to grow meat inside bioreactors without the necessity of fetal bovine serum. A nutrient-rich growth medium derived from the blood of unborn calves used by some cell-based meat companies. That's a lot to unpack there. Memphis Meats will use the new funding to increase its team from 45 to 135 employees and to build a pilot facility in an undisclosed location to begin scaling the production of its cell-based meat, a step that will bring it much closer to launching its flagship products to consumers. The pilot plant will also be crucial in demonstrating the safety of cell-based, also known as cultured, cultivated, and lab-grown meat, and Valetti plans to work with the United States Department of Agriculture and the Food and Drug Administration to establish a pathway to regulatory approval with the mission of creating a new modern system that is less detrimental to the environment, animal welfare, and human health. So we'll be following that. Of course, the challenge on that is, and maybe we'll have Paul to help us out here. I read that the fetal bovine serum and the fact that there is an origin from a cow, is it really vegan? Would a vegan eat it? Lots to discuss there. All right. When we come back, we'll be talking with Nicole Wilson from the Pennsylvania SPCA. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
Bless the beasts and the children.
All right, welcome back to The Other Animals on WWDB. We're joined now by Nicole Wilson. Nicole Wilson began her career in animal welfare in 1998, working in the Community Outreach and Humane Education Department of the Humane Society of Washington County in Hagerstown, Maryland. While there, Nicole established a behavior hotline to provide a resource for pet parents. In 2001, she moved to the Women's Humane Society, where she was a humane educator. On just her second day, she was recruited to assist in an animal cruelty call, marking the moment when her transition to law enforcement would begin. In 2003, she became a Humane Society police officer. And in 2006, Nicole moved to the Delaware County SPCA, where she was recruited to run shelter operations, develop a behavior program, and establish cat-friendly holding policies. In August of 2009, she joined the Pennsylvania SPCA's Humane Law Enforcement Team as a case manager before moving into her current director role. Nicole, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So where do we start? Well, let's start with your first that experience where you got called in for the very first time to go do an enforcement. That sounds like a life-altering moment. Tell us about that.
Well, as many people are familiar with George Bangle, who passed away back in 2016, he was definitely a force of nature. And he had approached me my first day on the job, and he said, so I hear you worked at another shelter before. And I said, yeah. He said, did you ever have to go deal with challenging animals, go pick animals up on the street? And I said, you know, a couple of times, just because you're at a small shelter, you help out where needed. Mm-hmm. And he said, I hear your parents are cops. And I said, well, my dad and stepmom are both state troopers. He said, so I've got this search warrant tomorrow. I was wondering, can you take pictures?
I said, yeah,
I can take pictures. He's like, so can you help me out? And I said, sure, I'm more than willing to help out. So we arrive at the location. We, generally speaking, as humane officers, are not inclined to break a door down to get in. We usually try and find a soft entrance. Mm-hmm. The basement window was kind of able to be jimmied up about halfway. And they looked around and they're like, who's small enough to go in the window first?
Oh, no.
I was like, I'll go in. He's like, all right, you go in, you just unlock the door, and you get us immediately. And I did, and the owner at the time was not home. We entered with police assistance as backup as well. And there was a very strong, terrible odor of deceased animal in the property, and the police smelled it, and they immediately, they're like, we need to walk out. So they walked outside, and we went and executed our search warrant. It was a property where George had been before. It was somebody who was a repeat offender, who had some mental health issues, and she was not home at the time, but arrived once we were just about done. We had found one living cat and the remnants of animals from the last time that they had been there. So it was kind of a momentous occasion. It, you know, the ability to save an animal from...
Were you able to just, what happened?
We pulled a cat out. They had previously saved from this person two dogs before. And, you know, she was an individual who had some significant mental health issues. She would basically stop taking her medications and then start to decline and
disregard the animals?
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, she would also disregard herself too. She mm-hmm. was not in the best of condition mm-hmm. herself at any given time. The interesting point for her was after George and I had moved on to the Pennsylvania SPCA about 2009, 2010, she called him up and she had finally gotten on her meds and had a better combination of medication that allowed her to stay on it for at least feel comfortable on it for an extended period of time. And she was like, you know, I really appreciate all you did for my animals.
Oh, wow.
Fascinating.
And so what you said your parents, your father had been a state trooper.
Yeah.
And so you sort of grew up in that sort of law enforcement mentality. But one might not think that... Where does the animal part come in for you
well,
as a kid? Where
did so my mom was a teacher mm-hmm. and my dad was a state trooper. And I had great grandparents that we spent a lot of time with. I was very lucky that my great grandparents were alive until I was my great grandmother until I was in late middle school and my great grandfather until I was in high school. And he was the guy who would walk his neighborhood constantly and just carry biscuits in his pocket.
Oh.
And every the worst dogs that like were just like people would think were just the most aggressive, and like he would come over and he would just like talk to them and they would like roll up and down and just love all over him, and he just like give them their little sweet biscuits.
And you went with him on those walks? Sometimes,
when we were lucky enough to be able to. And it was just that idea. And then, just always kind of being around animals. I was raised up in a more rural community. And I also remember back in the 80s when a number of farmers were losing their properties due to the challenges with farming and just the effect that that had. So it was a combination of, the love of animals and the appreciation for animals and the reality of how hard it is to properly provide care and how expensive it is.
So it's like, I can see now, it's the perfect, you had the love of animals, you had the law enforcement, here you are, right?
Yeah.
All right, so tell me, maybe my listeners are more sophisticated than I am on this, but I've always been confused with I know the general history of the ASPCA, the big ASPCA, and there's that guy, Henry Berg from New York, right? And his, we can maybe tell the story, but basically he had been appointed to in his 1863, I believe it was. Lincoln had appointed him to be like an attaché or liaison to the Tsar in Russia, and he was so appalled with the way they were treating the horses, and he comes back to the United States, and he sees the same thing, and he has to do something. So he founds this organization, broadly called the ASPCA, that is trying to do something about the treatment of horses. That's what I understand is the origin. And from there, then we got the big ASPCA, a lot of little ASPCAs. We have state SPCAs. They're sort of attached, sort of not. Help me out.
So basically, there were a number of people who were thinking about how the way we treat our animals was really a reflection on how we were as a society. Mm-hmm. And so you had people in Philadelphia, like Colonel Muckle, and you also had Carolyn Earle White, who at the same time that Henry Berg was thinking about this larger concept in New York, were also thinking about it from the point of view of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and how each of them could potentially affect change. And so Henry Berg established the American SPCA in New York City, but then both Colonel Muckle and Carolyn Earle White in Philadelphia established the Pennsylvania SPCA, and then simultaneously you had the Massachusetts SPCA being founded around the same time as well. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, they were basically associations that were going out and trying to figure out how to improve conditions for animals that mostly were viewed as utilitarian at that moment, mm-hmm. whether it was horses that were used for transportation or the livestock that was used as a food source or a fiber source, and then dogs that were basically being used as working animals to help on the farm or to provide some kind of pest control in the home environment. And so they were looking at those, and really the area that they saw to be most affected were the horses from the perspective mm-hmm. of transportation, because really people were depending upon these animals to provide transportation and to act as workhorses. And obviously, just like there are all kinds of people and how they treat one another, sure. and how yeah. they treat animals, mm-hmm. they saw all kinds of mistreatment of those animals on a daily basis okay. in the streets, both in the streets of Philadelphia and in the streets of New York. Mm-hmm. And so the things that they started with were small actions, like putting up water troughs to make sure that at any time a horse could rest and get an opportunity to drink, because some of the owners who were not as caring for their animals were not taking the time to allow the horse to be provided with necessary water to keep hydrated during that time. They were also seeing that laws were created to ensure that an owner couldn't continue to work a disabled animal. Mm-hmm. And that
So they before this, there were no laws.
Correct.
So the ASPCA is sort of still the ASPCA. They're starting to pursue legislation?
Well, the ASPCA could only work in New York.
Okay.
I mean, they could provide recommendations to other states, but ostensibly it would be organizations like the Pennsylvania SPCA that were going to be moving legislators in the state to enact laws on the state
level.
Because just because a law passed in New York didn't mean that it was in effect in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And so it was those early activists and advocates who led the way to make sure that really the basics were being provided. I remember looking at some of the old logbooks of the basically citations that people were being given.
Oh, wow.
And the things that,
that must be interesting.
You saw a lot of were people were being fined for plucking live chickens, for beating a horse or beating a dog. It was like very basic things that you were like, this is clearly not right. And and it was an easy, straightforward
who's
process.
Who's issuing the citations at that point? Is that law enforcement or is it SPCA?
It was SPCA staff who were acting as an arm of the law.
So I don't want to digress, but that's a part that I've always been another part of my confusion. So this organization founds and they start doing volunteer. They're like putting water troughs out for the horses. But how do they get to be a branch of law enforcement?
It was much like back in the day, many police force were private police forces. So it was not an uncommon or out of the ordinary process to think about. Like, we're enacted under the same statute that railroad police are enacted under. So
a private police department, corporate, you know, can have corporate security, and they are normally charged with protecting their own interest. They're part of the railroad.
Right.
If you use that example, the railroad. Tell me if I'm wrong. A railroad security guard, a railroad officer, only has jurisdiction around the railroad. No,
but for any crime committed around the railroad. So it was actually, if you were a railroad police officer and you witnessed a robbery, you would charge the person for the robbery. Or if you witnessed an assault on a person, you would charge them for the assault on the person.
Okay.
So it didn't necessarily have specifically to do with the property of the railroad.
And a citation or the charge like that would, even though it was, would have to be honored by the court system, the public
court. Right. Correct. And a person could be charged and, you know, could just pay their fine or they could fight it, whichever the case may be.
Interesting. Okay.
Generally speaking, if somebody was charged with something, there wasn't a lot of fighting over it or going back and forth. Usually it was just they paid their fine and they moved on.
And they moved on. So the SPCA's law enforcement arm develops out of that framework.
Exactly. Okay. And so that's really – and frankly, child welfare laws stem out of that same framework because – the first child abuse case that was prosecuted was done so in New York City by Henry Berg, under the animal cruelty law. And it was a social worker, Ms. Wheeler, who went to Henry Berg and had found this child, Mary Ellen Wilson, and she had been badly abused by an adoptive parent. And she said, surely if you can defend animals from abuse, you should take up this child. And he did. And then for a long period of time, many animal shelters also dealt with issues of child abuse. They eventually diverged and realized that that needed to be a state agency. Oh,
and thinking about the bumper that we can't bless the beasts and the children. That's what you're saying there was nothing protecting the children either? They were...
Correct. They were viewed as property, much like the animals.
Fascinating. All right, so at that point, so now they have, their private law enforcement branch. Now, fast forward however many years, and we have laws. I'm thinking of the federal, the Animal Welfare Act, which of course has been amended a gajillion times, even recently this year with PACT, and we start getting state legislation. Was the passage of all this starting to get this legislation going on both the federal and state level, and the fact that the SPCAs, and I'm putting that plural now, yes, the state SPCAs has sort of had a leg up on it. Is that how they sort of became the enforcement arm of all this legislation?
Well, and from a practical point of view, mm-hmm, if you're thinking about passing a law and thinking about from a state perspective, do you want to pay for that, sure, enforcement, or do you want to have these other organizations out there who are doing it for free,
yeah,
continue to do it?
Yeah.
And frankly, that's part of the challenge of where we are right now. Uh-huh. For so long, these SPCAs and humane societies have been doing the law enforcement work for free, that trying to make a case for why the state should start to pay for it,
yeah,
has been a challenge.
Okay. So do the SPCAs, so you mentioned issuing citations, uh-huh, and doing searches and rescues and those type of things. Do you have a arrest capability?
Yes. So we can charge for summary misdemeanor and felonies. We have powers of arrest.
You can handcuff someone and...
Yep. Have done it.
Oh. All right. Well, we want to hear about that. And we're going to come back to that. We're going to take a break here. When we're back, we're going to hear about your first arrest. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard. Come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net. or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
It shouldn't happen to man's best friend, but it does. Take a drive down a country road or a city street and you'll see them. Dogs left to spend their entire lives in solitary confinement, trapped at the end of a chain or inside a small pen. There's no crueler punishment for these social pack animals who need and deserve love, companionship, scratches behind the ears, and walks around the block. Please let your dogs live inside. Make them part of the family. For more information, visit PETA.org.
I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may
and we're back on The Other Animals on WWDB. We're talking with Nicole Wilson of the Pennsylvania Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. If you'd like to ask her any questions or have any thoughts, feel free to give us a shout, 888-329-3306. And before we get back, I just have a quick plug here for one of our former guests, Ingrid Newkirk of PETA. As you know, she was here back in November. She'll be a featured guest on Real Time with Bill Maher tonight, since it airs at 10 o'clock HBO here in the East. WWDB is off the air, so it's all right for you to tune in. Maybe, just maybe, Bill Maher, being an animal guy himself, he'll pop in for a few minutes on this show. You never know. All right. Nicole, you were starting to tell us about the first time you made an arrest. Can you?
Well, so many of the penalties when I started were at the summary level. And so there are only a few cases where you could argue at the misdemeanor or felony level. And so the first time that I had to arrest somebody in connection to a case, it was a starvation case of a dog being left in a yard when the owners left, and the dog ostensibly starved to death in that yard. Mm. We found the dog inside its shelter, frozen inside of it. So that individual was arrested, mm-hmm, and did eventually plead guilty. But again, we did not see any jail time for that back then.
That must be one of the, I was going to ask. So when you issue these citations, and sometimes I would imagine you see, for it to even get to the level that you are called in, that the SPCA is called in a law enforcement capacity, that it has already escalated. It must be very serious. Neighbors are neighbors are smelling something, you're hearing something, there's visible evidence that the dog's been chained up, whatever's going on, that it already has risen to a level of something that's being bad before you're even notified, then you actually are able to bring action under one of these laws. When the laws are coming along, you know, they're getting better, but they're still mostly, in most states, they're misdemeanor levels, slap on the wrist. I mean, that must be, well, what is it like? I mean, do you?
Well, you know, having been in the field for as long as I have been, to be fair, back when I first started, you're right. Most of what we were seeing was after it had progressed a very long time and it was not like early on in the process. Nowadays, because so much awareness is out there around animal cruelty, we are getting calls and being able to address things in a significantly faster period of time. That being said, in some cases where the animals are being maintained in the house and you don't necessarily see things until it's progressed significantly further down, or in a more rural environment where there aren't as many people who can visually see what's going on, then you get some pretty terrible things.
Yeah, but it's sounding like what you're saying is that as we've matured, that a lot of the work that the SPCA is doing, you're able to focus on the P part, on the prevention.
Right.
We
do our best. You know, we always say that 90% of what our officers do is about education.
Yeah.
And then the other 10% is where education won't be helpful.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that percentage of cases and times where, you know, it's not about somebody not knowing better. You know, you have a dog fighting situation. That's not an education piece.
Right.
You know, you have a breeder who's just doing terrible things, and that's not an
education
piece.
Right, you have to go do an intervention, or you have to take action. So some of those programs, so I was looking at, you have some really intriguing education programs. I'll ask you about, tell me about some of them, but I'm really curious about, there's two. Humane education. Now, my studies, we work with Zoe Weil, is a director. She's like founded this concept of humane education. And the notion with humane education is that it is, from what I recall, is that it filters across all education. In other words, you can apply humane education to math, science, right? It becomes part of it infiltrates all aspects of it. Is that the kind of thing that the SPCA is doing with its humane education program?
It's a little bit different than that. I mean, the idea of humane education being filtered across all areas, that's really something that has to happen in the classroom with every teacher. And the idea is that if you teach kindness in all aspects and teach that point of view in all aspects of education, it permeates the individual's reaction to everything.
Yeah, what is teach kindness? Just so,
yeah. And so what our humane education does is twofold. So part of it is going into schools and working with students on the concepts surrounding how we want to treat animals. And in turn, the idea is think about how you want to be treated. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes children are in a very different perspective from a power perspective. You know, a child has so many individuals that are controlling their environment and directing them, and they can often relate to animals being in that same kind of situation, you know, mm-hmm. where the animal is subjected to dealing with whatever is put in front of them without being able to express choice in many ways. And so a child can really relate well to an animal and think about that concept and think about what that means for them, and then in turn how they want to treat an animal. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the program. And then the other part of the program is not just working with children, but working out in the community with what we refer to as pet retention. Mm-hmm. And that is in cases where we have been called out to a case in a neighborhood where there has been generational poverty. And in those situations, providing individuals with the tools and the resources, because obviously part of the challenge is financial. Animals, the cheapest part of an animal is the first time you get it. Yeah, you know, right. You're never that's sure. The lowest amount of money you're going to spend. Yeah. So whatever you're paying for that animal at that moment, that is the least amount of money you're going to spend on that animal. And so a good percentage of the challenges that we see with owners and their pets and providing for their pets relates to that financial mm-hmm. burden. Mm-hmm. And so if we can take the financial portion out of it and look at what is the educational piece that's needed to bridge the gap between, you know, what they know about how to care for their pet versus maybe some things that we can teach them, and then providing them those resources. Like, you know, if a person can't have a dog in their house for a variety of reasons, let's provide them with a shelter structure and let's talk about why that dog ended up outside. Are there things that we can provide that might bring the dog back into the home, uh-huh. like a crate, like training programs, those kinds of things?
Oh,
and
see.
Then additionally, are there veterinary care issues at hand, like preventative medicine? You know, there are many simple things that can significantly impact an animal from a medical perspective, something like intestinal parasites sure. or fleas. You know, there are things that start out small but then can balloon for that individual animal. And if we can tackle them before they get larger and provide those owners with that information, you know, it really is extremely beneficial, and it helps keep an animal in the home and it helps the owner start to establish a positive relationship, not only with the animal, but then with our organization, mm-hmm. so that when something happens, if they need help, they know that they can call us, and it's in a positive way and not in a negative way.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because that seems always the ongoing challenge for law enforcement. Law enforcement always wants to be, you know, the neighborhood cop on the beat, your friend in the donut shop or whatever. They don't want to be seen as the heavy. That's the same. The same issue. I'm curious. So your education sort of has programs where you're going for the children, and you're going for the adults, for the owners. When you go into a school setting, how are you received? Do you ever get? Is there ever any wariness? Like, what are you guys doing here? Are you well? I imagine the children receive you really well. I'm curious about. The parents and the teachers, if there's ever been,
No, I mean, we're in there because both the administration and the teacher themselves are inviting us in. So it's the teachers are not usually an issue. Although we do find that in some settings that we're providing as much education to the teacher as we are to the students. Mm-hmm. And so that's beneficial. I think when it comes to, meeting parents in it really depends on the individual and what kind of history they have. Oftentimes our pet retention program is better received because it's not somebody in a uniform coming mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. talking to them. It's somebody offering to help on their terms. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the pieces of the pet retention program that sometimes has questions or pushback is the idea that we don't require spay neuter for our pet retention families.
Okay.
That being said, we've only had one family ever not spay and neuter the animal.
Interesting.
But it's a relationship building piece. So in most cases, people start out by saying, no, we don't want to spay and neuter. But
really?
then we find out, we start talking about the whys and the what, you know, the reasoning behind that. And then you start breaking down those barriers, and then they start to realize, oh, actually, it does benefit my animal. It does benefit uh-huh. my family. And it, like I said, we've only had one family
That's
in
right.
our pet retention program.
It's funny that as opposed to saying you must do that, where you would probably get much more resistance, or you would get people that just wouldn't sign up for the program at all, by giving them the choice, you wind up with this like 99%, you know. Plus. All right, there's one program that I have to ask you about. I'm really intrigued with it. Tell me about Working Cats. What is it? That sounds really like an amazing program.
So our Working Cat program, so most of the cats that are involved in our Working Cat program have actually come out of our cruelty cases. And the reason for that is we have a number of hoarding cases that we get where you have a large number of cats living in a home. Mm-hmm. And those, as a result, those cats are not getting the level of socialization that you would normally get from a small number of cats living in a home where they're getting the attention from an individual and or family.
Okay.
And so they're not well socialized, but are very good at being cats. They have significant prey drives. They are very good at pest control. And so the Working Cat Program surrounds these cats that haven't necessarily, you know, they're not the cat that's going to be picked up and put into bed with you.
Ever?
And it depends.
Okay.
I mean, it again, so the cats start out where they may not be as social as, you know, what a lot of people are thinking about, like the cat that they scoop up in their arm and they, you know, hug and love. But oftentimes they do become significantly more social than when they started out.
Right.
So it may not be that they want to be picked up, but it doesn't mean that they don't want affection. So these are cats that, you know, will accept pets, will accept interaction, and will solicit affection. They just might stop shy of the like picking me up and putting me into, you know.
So in the program, you basically put the cats to work, right?
Right. So basically what we see is oftentimes barns or warehouses where there's a concern for pests. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't feed the cats. You still put down food and water for the cats.
Okay.
But they will often, you know, instinctually hunt. I mean, my cats have a bowl of food down at all times, and it doesn't stop them from telling me exactly where that mouse is in the house if it happens to be there.
Yeah, right. I'm wondering, so this has been, we've had this a couple of times on the show. Tom's already listening, and his ears are perked up. We have, so the cats in this program, they're mostly outdoor cats, right?
They've lived indoors, and the working cats, it can be an indoor-outdoor environment.
Okay. So are they contributing to this thing with the birds?
So in the environments that these guys are in, not usually, because there's enough of an other type of pest. Like, the reason that they're being brought into this environment is because there's an issue there.
Mm-hmm.
And by virtue of the fact that they also are being fed, you know, the ones that are living in warehouses, they're not going outside, so they're not having that issue. And the ones that are in barns are in environments that, generally speaking, there's enough of the ground-based pests to worry about that it's not...
Okay.
You know, I mean, we have to be concerned about how cats impact the wildlife.
Sure.
But these guys are spayed and neutered. They are being provided with food, so it really isn't as likely to be the challenge as an uncontrolled population.
It's a fascinating, you know, you're getting the best of both worlds, kind of, because one of the things I always try to do is our human relationship with animals, not just companion animals, is, you know, we're trying to find that, say, quid pro quo, but there's a balance to be struck, you know. And it's not always black and white in terms of who's getting the benefit and who's not getting the benefit and who's being exploited. But it sounds like in a program like that there's a degree of mutuality there. The cats are getting something out of the deal. The humans are getting something out of the deal. We're sort of preserving the domesticated cat is such a, you know, well, should always be an indoor cat, you know, or the natural proclivities of the cat is that, well, she wants to be outside, like you said. We're constantly have this tension. You know, should we be allowing, as you said, to be cats, whatever that is, to be able to go outside and do whatever cats do, or since we've domesticated them, isn't the responsibility to keep them inside?
I mean, the fact is that generally speaking, cats that are indoor cats have a longer lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
But the alternative for many of these working cats would be euthanasia. And for us, we think that this compromise solution of a working cat is a much better solution than the euthanasia issue.
Okay. All right. We're just about out of time. So if there's let's tell our listeners, if they want to volunteer or if they wanted to go get additional information from the SPCA, how can they help out?
They can go to our website at www.pspca.org. We do have a strong group of volunteers that we are always expanding. Our volunteers work on behavior with our animals, making them more adoptable. Our volunteers also help with fundraising events, you know, and providing information to the public at large. We really value the contribution that they make to our organization because we are much stronger for them.
All right, great. Thank you very much. That's Nicole Wilson with the Pennsylvania Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. When we come back, Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls will be joining us. Don't go away.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard. Come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home. Would rather be home to catch mice.
And we're back to the other animals. We're joined now by Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good morning, everybody.
Hey, So the SPCA and veterinarians, you must have some experience with that, huh?
Well, it definitely got me thinking about, I used to work for a vet at Vet Hospital. They're very close to Mann Music Center in West Philly. And, dear Lord, the cases we would get come in there. It was actually, these were the responsible people who bringing their pet in. The ones I remember specifically, there was a lot of pit bull fighting that was going on back then.
Really? When is back then? How long ago was this?
I guess it was in the mid to late 80s.
Okay.
And it was particularly really bad, prevalent back then. And the ones who would come in, it was because of one of two things. It was almost always the same thing. They were cutting the ears off of their dogs for fighting. And then they wouldn't be able to control the bleeding, or they would get infected. And it would be one of their valuable dogs that they would bring in. They would never bring in one that, you know, was quote unquote unvaluable.
Oh my God.
And they were very dangerous people too. Cause I don't know that my boss ever contacted the SPCA about them because he didn't want to end up disappeared.
Oh my God. Wait. So you said they intentionally cut the ears off of the dog, or that was part of the result of the fight?
No, they would take razor blades or scissors and just do it at home surgery.
Wait,
it used to be common to the theory behind it was they would take the ears off so that it would not
the other dog getting a grip.
Right, exactly. Oh. And just the momentary pain of the cut on the ear during a fight might cause their dog to like lose a little bit of momentum. Now that's gone out of fashion now fighters have the natural ears for the dogs because they don't want that immediate recognition of being a fighting dog.
Exactly. This was very much the case back then.
Wow. But Tom, you're saying that it was the type of thing where you would have to treat the dog but not say anything about it, just don't ask any questions.
I'm assuming that's what my boss did, because I mean it was these were not people to play with.
Unbelievable.
So he was just trying to help the dogs.
Yeah, we used to, a veterinarian that passed that used to work on Erie Avenue blocks from the shelter, Dr. Marsh, he used to joke with me. He's like, I'm pretty sure that you at least have to have a misdemeanor to walk in my door because I'm just known for that.
Wow.
To some of the vets just viewed it as they were going to make sure that the dog got the best of care at the moment, because that was what was within their control. And, you know, that was just the perspective. Many changes have been made in the minds of most veterinarians in this day and age, that they are reporting. And under Libre's law, there has been a civil protection added for veterinarians and veterinary technicians to allow them protection civilly from somebody coming back at them when they file a complaint of cruelty.
Have you, Tom, have you ever had to apply that? Do you know the law she's talking
about? I personally have not. You know, I guess it's really a function of the way my job is.
I was going to say, because you go into people's homes, you're sort of, pardon the pun, you're sort of sheltered from a lot of that. I hear it as though you kind of paid your dues in a way, right?
Oh, yeah, I saw plenty of stuff I don't feel like remembering.
Right, yeah. But I'm sorry if I'm stuck on there. So how would you treat like that sort of injury, the ear? What would you have to do? I mean,
if they were bleeding, you know, you just have to clamp them off and get some stitches into it to stop the blood vessels from that are bleeding. And then the infection, you know, you put them on and give them antibiotic and hope that they give them to them when they leave.
I was going to say, that's the other thing. Like, okay, if they're treating them like this, if there's anything that they have to go home with, what gives you the sense of comfort that they're actually going to, right, that they're actually going to do it?
I guess the fact that they brought them in to begin with in the first place.
And they brought them in because they're worth money to them. So the,
exactly.
the saving them is financially beneficial for the owner.
Wow.
Yeah, they didn't bring in the losers of the fights to be treated.
Yeah. All right, well, there was a second topic that came out that I thought might be have a chime in. Nicole was talking about the spay neuter, and I know we've had a minor controversy on the show previously. It sounds like the SPCA's approach to that is very much in line with what you would suggest. Spaying and neutering.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, certainly. I mean, it's such a major problem. I mean, you know, any animals that can be taken out of the business of creating a greater and greater stray animal population. I mean, it's our duty to help with that.
Yeah, I'm intrigued with the approach that Nicole was talking about, where it's sort of given, the choice is given to the owners, but not mandatory. And in that scenario, they're more apt to do it, all things being equal, presumably cost, right? And the SPCA kind of helps with that.
Yeah, for those.
I mean, I think the SPCA's costs are very reasonable. It's like it's you know, it's if you can afford a pet, you can afford their fee for getting them spayed, and you know, just help out with the world.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry.
And with our pet retention clients, those individuals are getting those services through funding that we have from different foundations and groups that are paying for that specific pet retention program. Mm-hmm. And so for those clients that are specifically part of a generational poverty area, those people are getting that service for free. And there are certain spots where we annually do program of free spay neuters. One is in West Philly.
Oh, how convenient. All right. Well, we are out of
strongly in favor of
there
that.
You go. There you go. And I'll bring it all back home. All right, we're out of time. I definitely want to thank my guest, Nicole Wilson. Thanks, Tom. Thanks to my engineer, Jason Duffy. Always want to hear from you with comments, ideas, or suggestions. Please check out theotheranimals.com. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. Next week, I got a very weird and unique look at displaying death and animating life. This is, we're going to talk about taxidermy and roadkill, and we're going to go from that to penguins and elephants who paint. And you just try and connect those dots. Well, our guest next week, author Jane Desmond, will help us do just that. It's going to be a really cool show. We'll see you then. Have a great week.